You got a busy kitchen this time of year? We're talking about food today, increasing our food literacy in a state where many get their own meat from what the natural environment provides. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. The objective here, recipes. So maybe have a pad and pencil ready or your own recipe to share. Our statewide phone number, 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. A local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. Email talk at alaskapublic.org. From beaver tail to exotic spices, from food alchemy to bear meat, food the subject on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network.
Get a career in less than a year in nursing or QMed or professional cooking and baking. Additional programs and course information online at avtech.edu. Classes in Seward and Anchorage start in January, so enroll now. This message sponsored by Avtech.
Increasing energy efficiency is an easy way to reduce energy consumption and save money. The Alaska Housing Finance Corporation now offers financing to publicly owned facilities to make improvements to increase energy efficiency. Find out more about how their loan program works and if there are public buildings in your community that are a good fit for the Alaska Energy Efficiency Revolving Loan Program at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by AHFC.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
I just love it that we have an underwriter that's a culinary school. I didn't plan it that way, just the way it came out. Well, here we are with Talk of Alaska, and we have in the past talked about food security. We've talked about eating local. We've talked about chefs and sustainability. And today we're taking a left turn. Or maybe a right turn and then a left turn. I can't quite tell, but it ought to be fascinating, and hopefully we'll all learn something about what we would like to eat and what we can do to make it more edible. First up on the show is Steve Rinella. He is the host of the TV show Meat Eater and has written a book now, Meat Eater, Adventures from the Life of an American Hunter. His TV show's on the Sportsman Channel. And he's one of these guys that writes about his hunting for article for publications like Field and Stream and so forth like that. He's been on the show before, and I'm glad to have him back. Welcome to the show, speaking to us from his home in Brooklyn, New York, Stephen Rinella.
How you doing? Hey, thank you very much for having me on. It's always a pleasure, and it's been a while since I was on the show, so it's good to check back with you guys.
Yeah, well, it's you're fun to talk with, and I really enjoy your writing. American Buffalo, I think, is a great piece of American nature writing, and you've kind of taken that thread of your personal relationship with your finding your own meat, and really kind of turned it into a livelihood. That's amazing, really, isn't it?
It amazes me all the time.
Yeah.
My intention originally was to be the opposite of a writer. Like when I was growing up, I liked to trap fur, you know, and sell, you know, try to trap muskrats and mink and raccoon. And I always dreamed of being, you know, a professional trapper.
Yeah, well, we all know what happened. But from around 1986 or so, everybody who trapped in Alaska suddenly discovered that there wasn't any money in it anymore because the market collapsed.
Yep, and that was me in the Midwest. And I made a major go of it. I really tried hard. I thought I was going to be a professional trapper. And then the prices got so bad at the time I got out of it. And somehow I stumbled on the idea of writing about the outdoors. I was just trying to maximize my outdoor time. And so I just got encouragement from some teachers. And so I wound up, I was supposed to be like living out on my own in a cabin. Instead, I'm on the phone talking on the radio. So, but fate leads you in strange directions.
Well, yeah, and you obviously plan your trips. You have brothers that you go out hunting with. One of your brothers is actually employed in Alaska, which I guess also then gives you certain privileges as a not quite a non-resident hunter, but hunting with a family member, right?
Yeah, I have the best place brothers you could possibly imagine, because I got one in Montana, where I lived for a long time, and he's still there. And I got a brother in Alaska, and so I do a lot of hunting in both those places. But really, I hunt a little bit around the world and all over the U.S., from the desert southwest to the east and from Alaska down you know, in the Florida, I like to hunt everywhere. And but those are a couple of my favorite spots. Alaska's definitely a favorite spot of mine to go hunting, and I enjoy spending time with my brother up there. And he's very well equipped, you know, with all appropriate watercraft and vehicles, and he knows the state very well. So he gets me into a lot of good action. Yeah, a lot of good action and a lot of good eating.
Well, yeah, and that's where we want to go, is to the eating part. My nephew came up here. I guess it's not his first trip to Alaska, but this was a trip deliberately to go moose hunting, and it had to be one of these with an outfitter and getting dropped there and seeing what happened. And they did manage to get one moose, the group of them, and they dropped it in some water and had to. You would know what that would lead to, because that means you've got to put a lot of care into how you dress it out, and it's real heavy.
Yeah, there's nothing quite as bad as like a sopping wet hide and sopping
right.
wet meat.
Yeah, and so they struggled with this, and there was a weather challenge, but you know they got the moose cut up, and he went back to Pennsylvania with his part of the moose, and I made him promise while he was here that he would get it out when I went visiting. And so when I went there in late October, he hauled it out, and all he did, he got a nice piece of meat, and he cut it thin, and he just fried it up with butter, salt, and pepper, and that was it. And he,
you know what, he could have done a lot worse.
It was fantastic. it was fantastic, and I had family members there who were, you know, like maybe anti-fur and a number of different religious persuasions and dietary persuasions and so forth, and every single one of them was eating that moose and loving it.
I have seen. I'm not kidding you when I say this. I have seen literally. I don't want to over-exaggerate. I don't want to exaggerate at all. I have seen in with my very own eyes at least a dozen self-proclaimed vegetarians and vegans break their vow in order to eat game meat that I'd prepared. The curiosity was just killing them.
Well,
you know?
And the smell, too. I mean, you know.
Yeah. They'd grown up eating the other stuff, and then they were kind of like, well, you know what? If you went out and went through all the trouble to go hunt for this thing and take such good care of it, and it was a wild animal, you know, living out its life in a natural ecosystem, and was killed humanely and quickly. It's like that, partaking of that experience is worth breaking, I think. And some of them even went back to doing what they were doing, went back to their self-imposed dietary restrictions. But they had to step out of it because the curiosity was killing them, you know.
Yeah, and that's not uncommon. I've seen that happen in Alaska where people come here, vegans and vegetarians, and then discover, let's say, caribou, and say, well, I make an exception for that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you're not going to last long up in your guys' state. You're not going to last long as a vegetarian. That's one of the tougher places to be a vegetarian, I'd have to say. There's just a lot of great fish, a lot of great meat floating around that place, you know.
Yeah, so. But you know, as long as the barges come in, it is possible. But if the barges weren't coming in, that would be something else entirely.
You'd have some starving vegans running around there, I think.
Whoa, I'm telling you. Hey, but I understand you garden there in Brooklyn.
You know, I had a sweet garden, but I now I'm down to an herb patch because my wife is having a new baby, like in a week.
Ah.
And we had to move. We moved into a different place.
I see.
So now I could have fed. I mean, I could feed my whole family off my garden at my old place, and you know, for the summer months. I mean, my whole family being three of us. But now I got to start from scratch. I got to start. So this summer I'll get out there. But yeah, right now I got some potted herbs is all I have going on. But I do have mountains of meat. So we live a fairly carnivorous diet over here right now.
Yeah, and your objective is essentially keeping your freezer stocked with things that you have hunted yourself. In other words, you're trying to practice subsistence, actually, I guess since you were a kid, really, and you're still at it.
Yeah, in my own, you know, somewhat compromised way. And when I say compromised, I just don't want to BS you and tell you that, you know, that I don't eat in restaurants or, you know, like if I go to someone's house that I'll refrain if they're serving chicken, you know. I get around, I travel, I certainly take in some domestic meats, but in my home, like when in my home or when I'm at a close friend's place or wherever I go, I eat a wild game diet. We don't bring domestic meats into the house. Not because I have a particular gripe against domestic meats. I really don't. It's just that I prefer to eat game meat. Hunting is the activity that I do. It's the lifestyle I live. So I happen to have around a lot of meat. And it's just much more enjoyable for me to eat a bad tasting piece of wild game that I harvested myself than it would be to eat like a good tasting piece of meat I bought at the store. I'd rather eat black bear that's been feeding on salmon if I killed it than to eat, you know, filet mignon from some meat market. It's for me, the experience and the story of eating almost outweighs any of the taste or culinary aspects of what I'm diving into. But with that said, I know how to cook wild game good. I've been doing it my whole life, and I'm not ashamed to say that I can make most anything palatable, and I can make a lot of things almost taste sublime, you know. So, yeah, wild game is a defining aspect of my lifestyle.
The telephone number is 1-800-478-8255-478-TALK. Stephen Ranella is our guest, author of Meat Eater, and this is Adventures from the Life of an American Hunter. And Stephen's been on with us before, but in this case, there are tasting notes sprinkled throughout the book about everything from squirrel to beaver tail, but not caribou. What you're going to save the caribou adventures for later, Stephen?
No, you know, I just run up against, you know, you run up against the limitations of print. And so I tried to handle as many things as I could in my book. And I do talk about, I think there's a picture in there of some caribou. But no, I don't do a tasting notes on caribou, but oddly, I'm cooking some caribou right now.
Wow.
But a thing is, a gripe I have, and I think I even make this point in my book, a gripe I have with some wild game cookbooks, and I've never, you know, I don't publish recipes per se. I talk about cooking, but I don't get into too much specifics. A lot of my recipes I've kind of stolen from great chefs, and so I try not to lay claim to them.
Well, right. Well, actually, you know, I'm sure we have some experts listening right now, and their participation is invited here, and I'm sure you would enjoy getting some tips. And later on, we'll have another guest on the show who is a specialist in cooking and spices and whatnot like that. So this could get real interesting, you know, recipe-wise. But, yeah, as you were saying,
I'll steal anybody. I'll steal your caller's recipes without hesitation.
Good.
But the thing I was going to say is, like, when it comes to members of the deer family, I think that oftentimes, like, moose, caribou, deer, elk, all these various things can be cooked very similar. It's like I'm much more interested in the cut of meat than I am in the particular animal it came from, with the exception of things like black bear or wild pig or other things. But, like, as far as the herbivores, the antlered herbivores, the cut matters to me far more than the species.
Well, yeah, and I just finished reading your section on mountain lions.
That animal's an exception.
You contrasted the backstrap with the leg, saying, "Well, you really got to know how to deal with that leg."
Yeah, there's a reason a lot of lion hunters take the loins and try to find another home for the legs, you know.
But you did succeed in finding some that could be eaten, right? Not prepared by you.
I've eaten a couple lions. I've never killed a mountain lion. I've spent a lot of days hunting for mountain lions. I've not killed a mountain lion. I've eaten some of them. And with that, I go with just a pulled pork kind of thing. And I do a lot of the same stuff with javelina. And people call javelina, like, people hate javelina. They call javelina skunk pigs. But I find that, like, people I know in Mexico love javelina, and they use it to make their chorizo. When I've done javelina, I like to try to throw a lot of flavor at it, a lot of spices at it. And, you know, earlier I mentioned I was cooking caribou. We're actually cooking. I'm kind of doing it like a dinner party right now. And I got a leg of javelina braising in my oven right now with kind of a Korean marinade spice blend. I'm going to do kimchi tacos with javelina. So I might very well be the first guy tonight who ever ate a javelina kimchi taco.
I wouldn't bet on that in the slightest, actually.
Really? You're probably right.
Well, I'm telling you, up here, first off, people travel, and we got a lot of Texans here, A. And B, I think Anchorage, Alaska may be the kimchi capital of the world.
Okay, you're right. You know, I was just trying to find like some cheap claim to fame, but you shot me down.
Our telephone number, 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. Stephen Ranella, you actually got to the point where you were trapping squirrels who were getting in your garden and cooking them. Is that right?
That's right.
This is borderline.
It's a questionable legality.
Yeah,
go
right.
Ahead, go ahead.
I understand it's a borderline legality.
So I'm not advising anyone out there to get into urban squirrel hunting. But I could talk about my past experiences if you're interested.
Well, yeah, I'm kind of interested in, because ever since you were a kid, you've been getting squirrels, right?
Yeah, here's why I like to explain as soon as I talk about eating squirrels. Because I don't eat squirrels ironically. I don't eat squirrels for shock value for other people. And what I think that even people in Alaska who are from Alaska and live in Alaska their whole lives might have a hard time picturing is squirrel season is a big deal in the Midwest and in Appalachia and even parts of the West and parts of the East where you have like a specified squirrel season. So when I was growing up in Michigan, September 15th, was the opening day of squirrel season. It ran until December 31st. You were allowed 5 squirrels a day. And so we would talk about the opener of squirrel season excitedly. And our old man, our dad, would even let my brothers and I sometimes knock off school early in order to get out for the afternoon squirrel hunt. It was a big deal because a kid with a .22 could wander around anywhere he wanted pretty much in my area, and hunt squirrels. You didn't need supervision. You didn't need a lot of money. You didn't need a vehicle. You could just go out and hunt squirrels, and you might get lucky and get one or two. And my mom would cook them by just cooking them in a crock pot with cream mushroom soup and all kinds of different ways. We'd make Hassan pfeffer with them. And now I often find myself explaining to people how much I enjoyed hunting squirrels, how much I enjoyed eating squirrels, and they'll sound incredulous. And then I'll say to them something like, well, you know what? I bet I could change your mind about this. And then I'm in the situation where I need a squirrel. And so I might just go out and get a squirrel. Even if I'm home in New York, I might just go out and get a squirrel. And the problem is you can't discharge a firearm here. So it leaves you to other means. And I've done some squirrel trapping using traps similar to what you'd use on mice and rats, you know, like a big rat-type snap trap. And I'll cook them up, and I've yet to serve a squirrel to someone who wasn't impressed by the meat.
And the way that you described it, and I have never tried it, about as far as I ever went with anything like this was frogs, which are the legs are delicious and not all that difficult, but for a squirrel you say it's not fibrous exactly, but it comes off of the bone in a muscular sort of way, I guess you would say.
Yeah, you can cook squirrel down for a long time, and I've even done this with the pine squirrels that you guys have so many oven areas. But if you cook squirrel down for a long ways, it'll even when you go to eat it off the bone, it kind of comes off in its own little muscle groups. It's kind of cute the way it happens. But it's similar to very dark turkey meat, particularly if you're familiar with wild turkey, because it's similar to the dark meat on a wild turkey. And it really doesn't taste anything else. We're always brought into this problem when discussing certain kinds of wild game, whether it's frogs, snapping turtles, you know, squirrel, rabbit, where we run out of comparisons because so many Americans are familiar only with beef and chicken. So when you're describing something, you'll have this whole suite of species, and you have to go like, what's it like? And we always have to go like, well, it's like chicken, which is to say it's not like beef, you know, because the comparisons we have are so limited. So squirrel really is like squirrel. If I had to compare it to something else, I'd say it's kind of like rabbit but a little darker.
Yeah. Well, what about what about the spruce hen, which we have a bunch of here?
Of the upland game birds, it's probably the strongest, piniest one I've run into. A blue grouse, or now they call them dusky and sooty grouse, you know, are phenomenal and very mild. And I love rough grouse, and I love sharp-tailed grouse. But, yeah, the spruce grouse, I mean, I'll eat them all day long. But I think that even, in my opinion, I would probably even rather eat ptarmigan, which are not bad at all, than the spruces because they do have that piney smell. in a slightly piney flavor. But then you look and people, you know, clean their houses with Lysol, so we're not like automatically opposed to the piney smell. We just don't always like it on our palates. But again, I would rather eat the spruciest spruce grouse or spruce hen than a grain-fed chicken, just because it's more interesting to me. I don't think that every animal's job is to taste good from a sort of McDonald's perspective. You know, I think that some things are just allowed to be interesting and unique, and their value is just that.
Do you get a lot of talk radio gigs?
No, I mean,
that's
what,
because
no,
you,
I,
you
I
put out some pretty good
on the radio a little bit. So.
Yeah, you put out some pretty good sound bites there. It's pretty funny. I like that. Oh, Scott has joined the program from Homer. Welcome to Talk of Alaska with Steve Rinella, Scott.
Thank you so much for this program. my family brought us up to Alaska in 57 to Fort Rich, and I've mostly lived up here all my life. And I recently went through a three-year bout with cancer, and the issue of diet came up quite a bit. And so I've been cleansing, and I found myself looking around, living on the peninsula, for more wild game. I think it was generally cleaner meat and less fat. And my neighbor, who hunts quite a bit, said if he were to hunt for moose, he'd be going up to Fairbanks, which is where I lived from 1960 and for about 30 years. So I love this program. Thank you so much for having it. I feel very encouraged about, you know, eating more wild game. I felt I'd kind of lost that right almost, even though I've been here all my life. So many people are competing for the wild game. I didn't want to, you know, go out and hunt cow moose, for example. But this has given me a new perspective, and thank you for that.
Scott, thanks for your call. And I wanted to ask you just a little bit about the relationship between cancer therapy and wild food, because this is I've talked to people who said that when they did cancer therapy, that was they felt better about the wild meat than any kind of domestic meat would have, you know, whatever hormones and adulterants of various sorts in it.
Right, and this is not easy for me in that our family is deeply rooted in Montana, which is beef, really, although some people make jokes about the sheep. But our friend Paula and John have made it easy in the last year for us to eat a lot of fish, and that's been good. However, when I think of meat, I really do think of something like beef. Like you say, there's chicken or beef nowadays, and I prefer the caribou and the moose and when I can get it. And so when the holistic cancer people got a hold of me, they kind of took me back to the way I was raised and just said, well, you kind of went astray for the last 20 years, and we're not saying you got the cancer because of that. Just you might want to think about your diet and more wild food. And so I don't really have any direct information about a correlation between wild food and my cancer, but it just makes sense to me.
Scott, thank you so much for your call and for sharing that.
You bet. Thank you.
It's Talk of Alaska. Our guest is Steven Rinella, host of Meat Eater. Got any thoughts on that that business about processed foods and so forth, Steven?
You know, I can't give you documented cases and documented scenarios. You know, I can't just come at you with numbers, and so I almost am reticent to discuss it from that angle, from a food safety angle. I feel better eating wild game. I feel like I have more energy, more active. I feel more mentally sharp eating wild game. But it could be psychosomatic, because I just love the process of getting wild game so much that it just makes me happier to know what I'm eating. You know, so that could be it. And it's funny because you just hear so many conflicting things, like, you know, that a wild meat diet's good for us, and other people say that meat, you know, is bad in any form, and we should avoid red meat altogether. And I always kind of look forward to this day when meat is just bad, like smoking and drinking. You know, I could picture moms in the future telling their kids, like, I don't want you hanging out with those boys who eat that meat, you know. You can almost just kind of picture that it would be like that culturally people would get away from it. But I never will. You know, I feel great. I feel like I could outrun and outclimb anyone I know who doesn't eat meat at all. So it just doesn't bother me, and I always feel great on a diet of wild game. But I can't tell you that's because of, you know, biochemistry or just because it's in my head.
Oh, you're getting them going now, Stephen. I think you're doing that on purpose. Let's go to Bruce. Joins the program from Clam Gulch. Welcome to Talk of Alaska with Stephen Rinella, Bruce.
Well, thank you. Great show. Question. When I was a kid living back in eastern Canada at my grandparents, they would put up hams, but also part of the hams were black bear.
What?
And I've looked, yes, I've looked high and low. I've gone through the university extension, et cetera, to properly cure black bear as a ham. And they did the same way with the belly fat, which was Canadian bacon. The original Canadian bacon that you bought in cans was black bear.
Oh, my God. Stephen Rinella, you
can
got
I,
any...
Do I get to speak to this one? Because I can be more helpful.
Please.
I have cured many black bear hams. There's a couple things to think about here. When you look at like a air-cured or air-dried meat, like a prosciutto-type ham, what they're typically done with is they're done with the skin on. So you'd have to take your bear then and scald it and scrape the hair off and leave the skin on to make one of those. I don't do that. What I do with my black bear meat, I do everything, do the front legs and back legs the same way, where I take it off at the knee and do from the knee to the shoulder or from the knee to the ball joint on the back leg. And I smoke those, but I do them in a brine at a ratio of this. I do 1 gallon water, 2 cups salt, 1 cup brown sugar, and I brine those pieces. Let me step back, because I remove as much of the fat as possible. I'll take the bare fat and just render that down into lard, and I keep that lard in jars, and I put them in my freezer, and I use them for making baked goods, and I use it for frying, just like how you'd use oil. So once the leg is cleaned of the fat, I brine in that solution, like I said, gallon, water, 2 cups salt, 1 part sugar, and I leave it in there for up to 10 days in that brine. Then I flush it in clean water for a day, where every couple hours I pour off the water and add clean, fresh water to that, because I'm trying to then pull out the saltiness. I've used the salt for a cure, but I'm now trying to pull it out. And then I do them in my smoker, and I smoke, and then I hot smoke them. So I put them in my smoker at about 170 degrees, and I leave them in my smoker until the internal temperature is safe. Remember, black bears carry trichinosis, and they account for the vast majority of cases of trichinosis in humans in this country today, some 90-some percent. Trichinosis has basically been eradicated from domestically produced pork. So you got to cook it up to a point, but trichinosis dies at a low temp. So if you cook that bear ham out to 155 degrees, there you go. It is phenomenal. I like to eat it where I just cut thin slices off and I eat it with like a coarse mustard and rye bread. I'll do it as like a breakfast ham, and I'll just do ham and eggs. I use it for every application. And when I'm done, I take the bone and I use it for making split pea soup. And I don't ever buy or even desire pig ham because I do so many bear hams. In fact, I got a couple of bear hams in my freezer right now that I'm supposed to be doing for a buddy of mine, where I get to do two of them, give one back to him, and then I keep one.
How's that, Bruce?
That is fantastic, because
I'm telling you, man, you will not regret.
I got two black bear this spring. And I'm here to tell you, I went crazy. Of course, I had to eat a lot of roasts and steaks. You know, it was terrible. Make up some stews. But
yep, clean that fat off, though, man. And clean that fat off before you.
Recipe. Thank you.
Yep, and like I just kind of stepped over, but I just wanted to make sure. Clean that fat off good, even before you freeze it, because the fat will still go rancid in the freezer. And I'll a lot of times hear from guys who freeze black bear, and they'll say that when they first shot it, the bear meat was good. But then like 6 months later, they pull some out of the freezer, and it tastes, you know, the old catch-all phrase, gamey. And what's happened is that fat will actually turn in your freezer. You can take pork back fat and put it in your freezer and pull it out 8 months later, and the stuff will actually be rancid. So fat breaks down. And the same way, like when you age meat, you're getting something, a much slower version of the same thing in your freezer. It's not completely static inside there. So with the black bear fat, get that fat off and just try to freeze it as lean as possible and then trim it again before you cook it. If you want to save the fat, render it, because then you're getting rid of the solids, you're getting rid of any water in there, and you have pure black bear lard, and it will last literally. I'm not joking here. It will last years and years. I have a bottle I'm just keeping as an experiment. I have a 7-year-old bottle of black bear lard. Doesn't taste any different than the day I made it.
Bruce?
You can't cook with anything better than black bear lard. That's a fact.
No, I love that
stuff.
All right,
thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. We're talking with Stephen Ranella, host of Meat Eater and author of Meat Eater. And some of his food preparation hints are included in his book, Meat Eater, Adventures from the Life of an American Hunter. Stephen, if you can stay with us here past the break, we'd appreciate it. Maybe you have to run and tend to your cooking there for tonight. It's getting on.
No, I put everything on hold just for you. So.
Oh, fantastic. Well, can you stay with us?
Absolutely, yeah.
Before we take our break, let me ask you this one thing, because every once in a while you start coming off like Ted Nugent, and I'm wondering, what's your attitude towards trophy hunting?
Well, for me, a trophy is something that has to be emblematic of something meaningful in your life and something you're proud of. I do keep around, my home is decorated. Right now I'm looking at a set of moose antlers. I have doll sheep heads, javelina, black bear, mule deer, whitetail, skulls all over my home. And they're all animals that I killed through fair chase hunting practices, largely on public land, and things that I use to feed myself and my friends and my family. And so when I look at these trophies, as we say, I'm looking at a long-standing emblem of some activities and behavior that I'm proud of. And if you go back in the historical record and look at indigenous cultures, I would think that, you'll find many examples of people who did honor the animals they killed by wearing tokens taken from the animal and decorating one's home with the animal. So, no, I can't tell you that I'm not opposed to it. It's just part of a broader package. To kill an animal strictly for that, I think it's atrocious. I had a friend who used to work as a packer for an outfitter out on the Alaska Peninsula, and the whole time he worked there, he never saw one client from the lower 48 ever bring home a pound of moose meat. All they brought home was the antlers. There was a constant rush trying to get that stuff into food banks and processors, and they weren't interested in it. That's an abomination in my mind. But if you're hanging up emblems of fair chase hunts that you've eaten, great, man. Decorate your house so it won't hold anything else.
All right. Outdoor writer Stephen Ranella, our guest as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. First National Bank Alaska, offering business solutions to help Alaska's dreams grow for 90 years. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC.
And by the Federal Aviation Administration, setting standards for the operation of aircraft in airports. FAA.gov/go/flyalaska or toll free at 1-866-357-4704.
It's Talk of Alaska. We're talking about food preparation, and you will not find bear lard mentioned, I don't think, in the book by the author who is our next guest, Meadow Lynn. Meadow Lynn is author of the Mystic Cookbook, The Secret Alchemy of Food. The book is actually not quite out from the publisher yet, but we thought it would be interesting to have her on today's show, and she accepted the challenge with relish, even. Meadow Lynn, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Hi, Steve. Thank you so much for having me on. I love that. I'm thinking next recipe, next book, bear lard. Maybe that could be a whole theme for the next book.
Well, I one thing that you can count on If you do a call-in talk show in Alaska and you start talking about things like how to prepare your game, you're bound to get a bunch of callers. The only thing I've seen that gets them more excited is talking about the practical details of burying a Connex to make a root cellar out of it. I think that only in Alaska would this happen, but it does happen. And so I'm glad to have you in on the conversation. I don't know if you've been able to listen for the past few minutes.
I just caught the last few minutes, and I loved Stephen's answer about the trophy hunting. I thought that was really eloquently put, very succinct, and follows exactly with my line of beliefs.
Well, Stephen Rinella, meet Meadow Lynn, and Meadow Lynn, meet Stephen Rinella. Do you, Meadow, maybe have a question for Stephen right now?
Oh, goodness. I would just love to. I don't know what he said before. I'm sorry, I missed the beginning of the interview, but I'm fascinated by what you're doing, and you're making me hungry.
He's cooking right now. He's actually having people over, and he's got caribou, and what else do you have in the works there?
Got some javelina.
You know what a javelina is, Meadow?
Some doll sheep and a Himalayan tar.
You don't have javelina in Alaska, though, do you? There is.
No, I don't live in Alaska. I have javelina from.
Oh, okay.
I have javelina from West Texas. I have a Himalayan tar that I'm cooking from New Zealand, and I have a caribou and a doll sheep from Alaska, parts of which I'm cooking right now for a dinner party tonight.
Yep.
Wow, that sounds like quite a dinner party.
Yes.
I have not had javelina. We have wild boar here in California, but I've only seen javelina. I have not tasted them.
Yeah. Well, I'm excited to hear about your own project, but I don't want to hog the conversation here.
No. No danger of that. Meadow, also I tell you this about Stephen is that he has a son now who is growing up mostly on wild food from the freezer.
And gummy bears.
and the other things that children eat.
Which he recently discovered.
Yes. And his wife is expecting actually within a week or so. And so he'll have a second offspring to try and feed out of that freezer.
Well, it sounds like your kids are going to be well nourished and well fed with healthy and delicious meats.
Yeah, my son's already developed quite an adventurous palate, and it's funny to watch. I don't know if you have children, but it's funny to watch them because, of course, every parent wants their kid just to eat everything they put in front of them, and it started out great, and then we went through this picky phase that was driving me nuts, and now we're kind of pulling out of that, and now he's back to eating whatever you stick in front of him. and so it's the most stressful aspect of parenting is living with the idea that you might wind up with a picky eater.
Well, I think the more that you provide them different foods and awaken their taste buds, I think the less likely you are to have a child that's a picky eater. I've actually heard, too, that they say the more that children are involved in the entire process, if it's planting the seeds in their garden and harvesting or even hunting, and then cooking and working in the kitchen, that they are much more likely to enjoy their food, regardless of what it is. And even if it's something that they swear they hate, the moment they're involved in the process, they actually come to really enjoy it. So I think you have little worries there of your child becoming
I appreciate that bit of insight, because I'm going to continue to try to do that.
Well, when you think about it, Stephen, it really, the way that your dad had kept his subsistence going, even though he was, he's an Italian for Pete's sake. You know, somehow he's developing these American hunting practices and getting that taste into his kids pretty early on, don't you think?
Yeah, he made eating fun, you know, where he had this deep fryer he picked up at a restaurant liquidation sale, and it threw off a lot of heat and smoke, and he actually kept it up in his garage. But he would fry anything we brought home. And so it was always fun that we would go, and we would go up to the garage, and he'd send one of us up there with instructions to set that deep fryer at 375. And then, you know, a half hour later, we'd go up there, and we would just stand around frying stuff and eating it. And granted, it all came out tasting like frying magic, which isn't altogether bad. But it just was like a fun – it was kind of a spectacle, you know. And he would like to introduce us to – my brothers and I, it's just kind of like eccentric figures that he knew. I mean, he was a smart kind of parent who knows just to take your kids over to weird people's houses to hang out. And we would go over, and one of his best friends used to just eat salmon eggs right out of the salmon, you know. And they would cook all sorts of wild mushrooms and wild game, and it was just always a good time. And we'd eat salmon that you got that people in Alaska would generally not go near. We'd just eat like really spawned out, you know, half white salmon that we'd pull out of those Lake Michigan tributary rivers and boil them, or, you know, pickled salmon, all kinds of things. And it was just always a good time. And I grew up with that, with just having a real reverence for the fun of coming together and eating, you know. And that's where a lot of my interest in hunting, that's what sustained my interest in hunting, is just that constant culinary curiosity. And it's a great way just to have novel items around home. And having a kid, it's fun, too, to introduce them to stuff.
Yeah. Well, Meadow Lynn, let's turn to what the theme is of The Secret Alchemy of Food in the Mystic Cookbook. I mean, you just were appearing, I guess, not an hour ago on your mom's TV show or radio show?
On her radio show, yep. It's been a busy morning. It's a beautiful, foggy morning, though. It's a nice, cozy to be chatting here with a cup of tea. And actually, today, The Mystic Cookbook is being released by Amazon today, so we're pretty excited. And the book, I co-wrote it with my mom, Denise Lynn, and we're blending my passion in cooking and eating, which if you like to cook, you generally like to eat, with my mom's background in spirituality, and kind of creating a book that pulls together those different ideas where you can infuse energy and spirit into your food. I don't know if you've ever noticed how sometimes food, like cooked by your mother, for instance, tastes better than cooked by anybody else, that it's more nourishing because she's filled it with that kind of motherly love. And then we've talked a lot about kind of the mood-food connection and how eating mindfully can affect all aspects of our being, from mind, body, and spirit, that food isn't just about absorbing calories to fuel ourselves to keep going, but it's much deeper than that, as I'm sure Stephen could tell you, too, with the experience that he's had looking his dinner right in the eyes and seeing how there is this deeper connection between what we eat and how we feel.
Yeah, I am. Maybe you could give me a little bit of a sample recipe, something that I might be able to. Let me think of something. Okay, I'm gonna just. I'm gonna take chicken.
Okay.
And okay, so we got this chicken, and we can go to the store and get some more ingredients to go with the chicken. Mm-hmm. So what would you recommend if it's going to be a meal that we're preparing for the grandchildren?
Well, there are a lot of different things you can do. One thing you could do is you could start out by buying a free-range organic chicken to start out, to get, you know, one that's been raised humanely. That's one way you can do it. Another way, if that's not available to you, or you could raise your own. I raise chickens for eggs. I'm not quite ready to raise meat birds.
Right, but we have a lot of chicken keepers in Anchorage, actually. I don't know if it's spread so much over the rest of Alaska, but they had an active lobby. They went to the assembly and said, we want to be able to keep chickens. And the assembly said, okay.
for meat birds or eggs or a little bit of both?
Well, the main problem was the roosters and the noise.
Yeah.
So no rooster, but yeah, people keep them for meat, but also for eggs. But I mean, you can't really separate the two. And I you're going to find this out, Meadow. You can't really separate the two. There comes a point where you don't get eggs out of your chicken anymore.
No, that's true, but I only have three, so they're more like pets. But yeah, it's true. There will come that day, and I have taken part in. Well, I haven't actually culled any chickens myself, but I have friends who have.
Yeah,
but
I used to work in a butcher shop, and by golly, we'd go out back there with a load of chickens, and pretty soon we'd have chicken meat.
Oh, yep. And that is definitely one of the great ways to start, because you know then that chicken has been raised with care. But if that's not available, you know, we suggest in the book you can get a chicken wherever it suits, you know, your budget and whatever shops are available to you. Another thing we talk about is, you know, there's power in prayer. Saying a blessing, a grace when you eat your meal or while you're cooking can also enhance the qualities, the energies of the food. And then the way you prepare it, you know, we say have fun. You know, so many people get stressed out about cooking or only cook for guests. And I think, you know, why not cook for yourself, for your family, when in the way that you would for guests, and treat yourself as an honored guest. So I live by myself, but I made a roast chicken for myself last night, actually. You know, sometimes people are like, oh, that's just for guests. But, you know, why not? I made a roast chicken. I had some roast sweet potatoes, salad. I made myself a lot of courses because why not? You know, why not treat myself? So we offer a lot of different tips and suggestions on ways that you can savor each and every day, each bite, each moment, by the way that you you prepare those meals. So there's a lot of different things you could do with that chicken.
Well, you know, you go into a restaurant and there's this, what they call plating. And essentially they're paying attention to presentation and color and so forth. And my wife, Johanna, she's very big on color of the food. She wants the food to look good. And it's just not even questioned. It has to look good before it's going to taste good.
And that is so true. It sounds like your wife and I would get along very well. I believe very much in the power of color in our food, that it is not just the way it tastes, but the way that it looks makes a big difference. One of the examples I like to use is oysters on the half shell. First time I ever had raw oysters, I was camping in Oregon with my mom, and I was just a little kid, and we got them fresh off right at the beach, you know, from one of the processing plants. They were in a jar, but they were fresh, just been shucked. And then we ate them at our campsite with a plastic spoon out of the jar. I cannot tell you how disgusting I thought they were. It wasn't until years later, and I was actually studying in Paris, and I went to a little cafe with my boyfriend at the time, and we had wine, and there was probably an accordion player an accordionist on the corner, and it was all very romantic, and we had oysters on the half shell with a little mignonette sauce, and gosh darn it, those oysters tasted so good. And it had to do with the presentation and the aura of the entire meal that made such a difference, that it wasn't just the taste, even though they were equally fresh and the same, you know, supposedly the same, you know, it was the same, they're both oysters, is what I'm getting at.
Oh, you're hitting me right where I live. You know, there's this place in Marseille, and this is common, actually, in coastal France, where there's a fish store with a restaurant in back, and you got to pick the fish in the front, and then they cook it for you in the back. Oh, my heavens.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. I actually also lived in the south of France in Aix-en-Provence, and I used to go to the fish markets in Marseille, and it was so great. They just pull their boats right up there onto the harbor there, and the fish were still swimming practically.
Yeah.
they were selling them.
Well, I was there for about a month last year, and it's slim pickings these days out of the Mediterranean, but they still do it. They still come and bring that stuff. Meadow Lynn is our guest, author of The Mystic Cookbook, and Stephen Rinella, host of Meat Eater, as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Grant Station, your fast track to funding, helping identify appropriate grant makers for your organization's programs and projects. On the web at grantstation.com. Providence Imaging Center with Drs. Scott Nespinski and Christopher Reed, providing interpretations of imaging studies with a focus on musculoskeletal radiology. PROVimaging.com. And by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
The subject is the endlessly fascinating topic of food preparation on Talk of Alaska today. Stephen Rinella, the author of Meat Eater, how do you feel about presentation of what you've prepared?
I agree wholeheartedly. I think that when things look good, they're going to taste better. And for me, presentation comes down to something that I appreciate, a rustic look. And I appreciate things that are a nod to, that give a nod to where they actually came from or what they actually are. So I enjoy, we were talking earlier about smoking bear hams. I enjoy serving smoked bear ham in the hole with the ball joint poking out of the end of it. Like, I'm not hiding what it is we're looking at, you know. I like to eat just raw game meat with a slice of garlic on it, where you look at it and just unmistakably you're looking at a piece of raw meat laying there, and I enjoy that more. I enjoy camp.
Whoops. We lost a connection.
Oh, no.
Oh, well.
That was fine. I was just
he can rhapsodize.
That raw meat.
Oh, I'll tell you, Stephen Rennell is a hell of a writer. I mean, he's just like, he can go on like that forever. We're almost at the end of the show. We'll see if we get him back or not, and we'll try and bring in Tricia here to the program from down Anchor Point, which is not far from where, well, there's a good salmon run there, and also it's not far from Clam Gulch and Klamath Country. Tricia, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that I raised my kids in a remote bush, not in Anchor Point, but and they're kind of a case study of children that grew up on pretty much just wild game. You know, we got a moose every year. We get about shoot about 3 trouble black bears in the summer, and but even brown bears overlooked. That's good stuff in the spring, and clams and fish. But anyway, they're very healthy, intelligent, good teeth. And one time we had a visitor come, and he brought some T-bones because he's from beef, because he thought we'd, you know, kind of like a change of pace. And my daughter, she loved them, thought they were great, but then she vomited all night long.
Oh.
So she wasn't used to the fat, I think, you know, ribbed through the meat like that.
Yeah, yeah. Very good point.
She was on her first moose kill at age 2, and I remember one time going into the Kenai Mall when she was 1, and she was just toddled over to the stuffed ptarmigan in case, and she pointed at it and went, num, num.
Tricia, I want to thank you for your call. That's great.
Yeah, good show. Thanks.
It's Talk of Alaska. We're talking about food preparation, and we lost our connection with Steve Rinella. We may get him back. Meadow Lynn is also with us, the author of the Mystic Cookbook, The Secret Alchemy of Food. Meadow, let's turn to spices.
Ooh, one of my favorite topics. Once again,
I've noticed that the American palate, Meadow, has mm-hmm. totally changed in my lifetime. Whereas all the cooking magazines and everything, it used to be very bland. And in the last, like, 15 years or so, that's totally changed. And, you know, Thai food came in and all sorts of highly spiced foods. And I think you get more of this on the West Coast than you do in the East or the Midwest. But, dear heavens, I had no idea you could spice as much as you can.
Amazing to see the transition. I grew up in Seattle, and I remember as a child the influx of Thai food, and we had it there, I think, before other places in the country because of our location, and we had a large Asian population. And now, I mean, even tiny towns in the middle of nowhere have Thai restaurants. But you're right, food, the culture of food here really has changed, and with show networks like the Food Network, now it's part of our daily vernacular. Turmeric and cumin, you know, these are things even little children are talking about. But we talk in the book about kind of spice alchemy and how in the Middle Ages, spices were considered to have mystical powers. They came from the East, so it was assumed that they'd come from the promised land. And the wealthiest people had the most spice, whereas now you show your wealth in different ways. Back then, the more spice you had, the more wealth you had. So we can kind of tap into those, that ancient alchemy, if you will, those ancient beliefs, and whether it works or not, sometimes it doesn't matter. It's like an aphrodisiac. They probably don't have much, you know, the capsaicin and chilies, you'd probably have to drink so much you'd be spitting fire to really get enough to have the aphrodisiacal qualities. I don't even know if I said that word right, but to have the qualities from it. But if you believe it's strong enough, and it's the same with the spice alchemy. So we suggest, you know, when you sprinkle that little bit of cayenne or whatever into your hot chili, into your cocoa, I have a recipe for what I call a mystic elixir for love. It's hot cocoa, but you sprinkle a little bit of cayenne into it with the intentioning of opening your heart to love. And, you know, whether chemically it actually, you know, brings more love into your life, it may or may not. But with that intention of, I'm going to put this little bit of cayenne in, which actually really enhances the flavor of the cocoa, but also it invites a little bit of possibility. It opens that door to more love if that's your intention and that's your belief. So,
Meadow Lynn,
you're
selling books now. Why don't you start with that sort of thing? Let's go to Vernon. Joins the program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Vernon.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
Hey, Meadow, you said something earlier, and I just want to get a clarification on it. You talked in your book about how, you know, the book, how everything tastes better from motherly love.
It can.
Well, I got to kind of disagree, because on the weekends, I'm the one who cooks, and my daughters both love it when I cook. So you got to add a little fatherly love in there, too.
Oh, well, yes, you are so right. Fatherly love, too. I guess what I was getting at was that nurturing quality of a mother or father, that it really, they say in India, they say it's a mother's love, probably because traditionally it's the mother who does the cooking. But it would be the same with the father, too, that because you have so much love for your children, that actually that love goes into the food. And I know it sounds crazy. It seems like that's whoa, woo, woo, way out there, but it really does make a difference. And that's why a lot of traditional cultures do say that. And you can have, mm-hmm. I don't know if you've ever had one dish, a identical dish made by two different people, and it doesn't taste the same. That would go along with that idea as well.
Yeah. So you actually, Meadow, in this book, you've got recipes, right?
We do have recipes. They are all my original recipes in the book.
All right.
Most of them are pretty simple, with ingredients that you can find most places. And I've also photographed them all, too, so they all have beautiful color photographs.
Well, the pictures I looked at are very appetizing. Vernon, you had a question for Stephen Ranella? Got about a minute and a half or so.
Is he still back on?
Or? Oh, yeah, he's still here.
Hey, I had a technical glitch, but I'm back alive.
Hey, when I was listening, you were talking about, you know, growing up as a kid and always getting to experience different things, and you know, when you started talking about the pulled pork from the javelina, that brought back quite a few memories from growing up in Arizona, where my dad used to
hunt
quite a bit.
Okay, so you're an ancestral consumer of javelina, probably.
Oh, yes, yeah. I'm huge on javelina, and, you know, currently in the freezer I've got moose, bear, caribou, halibut, salmon, so...
Yeah,
I'll trade you pound for pound. I'll trade you pound for pound javelina for halibut anytime, man.
Heck, you can include me in that deal.
Yeah, you guys are making me hungry.
You know, it's funny because I've actually, for my leftover lunch today at work, I'm having taco soup made from ground up ground bear.
Oh, great. I'd love to hear from you. That's great, because I'd love to hear from guys, you know, hunters who are out there and just enjoying their wild game meat and eating it at work, and, you know, and it warms my heart to hear that. So that's great.
Well, you know, believe it or not, we run out of time. Vernon, thank you so much for your call there and your observations, and for chiming in. And Meadow Lynn, author of the Mystic Cookbook, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And we'll look at maybe we could do some more on this, because this is a whole lot of fun. You were a really good sport. Steve Ranella, always a pleasure having you on. It's just, I look forward to whatever comes out of you next.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
All right. I want to thank very much our crew today. Dave Waldron at the controls, Josh Edge on the phones. I'm Steve Heimel.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by Older Persons Action Group, promoting well-being for Alaska seniors and their families, including publication of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper. Membership information at 1-800-478-1059. And by the Muskox Producers Co-op, whose Alaska Native members hand-knit Kiviut items, located in the Little Brown House at the corner of 6th and H Street.
Increasing energy efficiency is an easy way to reduce energy consumption and save money. The Alaska Housing Finance Corporation now offers financing to publicly owned facilities to make improvements to increase energy efficiency. Find out more about how their loan program works and if there are public buildings in your community that are a good fit for the Alaska Energy Efficiency Revolving Loan Program at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by AHFC.
This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.